Hello all, welcome to the God Said of Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Drakonis Books. Kai Drakonis Books is an independent anarchist press dedicated to publishing socially conscious literature. With me today are my fellow editors, Chris Momberg and Hans Berger. And in this episode, we are going to chat about what I found to be a really fantastic and just awesome, really enjoyable book, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. However, before we get into that, I wanted to briefly relay an anecdote that doesn't have anything to do with the book that we're going to discuss, but I still think that it's pretty important to talk about, given that while we don't always deal with political subjects on this podcast, the press is a political in a broad sense, so I think it's appropriate to bring this up now. Yesterday, I kind of fell into a Black Lives Matter protest. My wife and my kids were driving downtown to downtown Cincinnati. This is May 30th, and you know, I was just going to a coffee shop to get some coffee beans. And we noticed the marchers were on the streets. And, you know, my wife and I had a little discussion. You know, she was worried about our kids. She didn't want to take them, you know, due to COVID-19 and the threat of police violence. But she said that I should go. So I went with the protest. We marched throughout downtown. And at one point, at a little rally point, a speaker asked us all to kneel down on our knees on the concrete for 9 minutes, which is the amount of time that Officer Chauvin knelt on George Floyd's neck. And in this time, the speaker counted down each minute, and you know, my knees began to ache, and you know, we really thought about how long that is, how long 9 minutes is, and I began to cry. And I just wanted to take, basically, I just wanted to take 1 minute of silence here at the beginning of the podcast episode to remember all the black men and women who have been murdered by police. Is that okay, gentlemen, if we just take 1 minute of silence?
Absolutely.
Sure. All right.
All right. So, yeah. So I know that listeners, you could have skipped over that minute if you wanted to, but hopefully you didn't. Hopefully you observed the silence with us. So before we begin, just want to say, fuck the police. They're a bunch of racist assholes. Let's talk about Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. I find it actually pretty serendipitous that we just talked about Milton's Paradise Lost, since Frankenstein seems to be responding in some kind of deep way to that poem. I don't necessarily know that we have to start off with that, but I don't know. What do you guys think? Did you notice any resonances between that text and this one?
I actually...
No.
No.
Really? You're fucking with me.
I'm fucking with you. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, all right.
Sorry.
All right.
Chris, I think you were going to say something serious.
No, but I kind of think it's sort of, I would say I mean, maybe you guys should talk about what you see as resonance with Paradise Lost, because I feel like the explicit connection is made to a text like Paradise Lost that has these clear sides in a conflict and has a lot of symbolic weight that sort of that is explicitly like manifested in religious contexts, and I don't know that I see connections between Paradise Lost and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, except in reference when the monster talks about Paradise Lost, reading it. I don't know, but maybe correct. Tell me what you guys saw. I kind of feel like there might be even something to talk about in its absence, but maybe that was my misreading.
Well, we can start with at least the references, so we kind of know what's going on. So what seems to be the emotional core of the novel is when Frankenstein and his creation meet up in the mountains, right? And the creation speaks from his point of view, and we get his story for the first time. And it's really, a heartbreaking story. And so the first reference he makes is that, you know, he kind of can understand Satan's position, right? Satan's mm-hmm. position, he can understand Satan's anger and, you know, for being kind of left by his creator and, you know, uncared for and whatnot. So there's that specific reference. And so it definitely seems to me like Shelley is carrying on the reading of Satan in Paradise Lost as empathetic, you know, not the central protagonist. I'm not sure it has a central protagonist, but definitely empathetic. But I think it maybe deepens, it's maybe deeper than Paradise Lost in that we all agreed, I think, that Satan should, to really be more empathetic or to be more interesting, would need to be a more complicated character. And
right. So
it seems to me that, like, Shelley has almost revised Satan with Frankenstein's creation so that he is that more complicated, more complex character that we like. If Satan were more like Frankenstein's creation, we would probably find him more interesting and more empathetic and more complex. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's interesting too. So just kind of a question to frame some of the thoughts that I had in response to that. Did you guys read the 1818 text or the 1830, I think it's 1831 text?
1818.
Okay. Yeah, I read 1818 as well.
I'm not sure. I'd have to look at my Audible edition.
Okay. The reason that I bring it up is, just background for those who aren't familiar with the distinction, which I was not when I went in, right? Like, I bought the 1818 text. I mean, the way bookstores work now, right? I called the bookstore and I said, hey, I want Frankenstein, and somebody in a mask brought it to the curb, right? So right. I wasn't necessarily browsing the racks to see all the different variations they might have had. But the key thing is that it was originally written in 1818, or originally published in 1818, and then Shelley revised it somewhat in 1831 and added a preface to the 1831 edition where she basically did what's become the first layer of interpretation, right? She added at that point gave us some of the readings of the text, which have in the long term informed some ideas people have about what it's actually about. Because the 1818 text, without her introduction, I found to be really quite mysterious, quite enigmatic, right? There's a lot that we're not told. There's a lot that we don't understand. There's a lot that's inexplicable. You know, the process of creation is inexplicable. To some extent, Frankenstein's reason for doing it is inexplicable. We don't know what the creature looks like. And kind of the key thing that seemed inexplicable to me in reading it was the violence with which Frankenstein rejects the creation, right? Mm. He makes it. He is immediately completely repelled by it. When it comes to him and tells him this, you know, rich, complex, sad story, he's incapable of having anything other than this kind of gut-level revulsion, right? Which, I mean, to some extent that's understandable, because at that point, I think at that point, if I remember right, it's strangled his 6-year-old brother. But that being said, because we're getting the creature's story reflected through Frankenstein, there's a level of depth that the character has that we know Frankenstein has to understand, because he's the one who's relaying that story to the captain, who in turn is relaying it to us, right? Because of the kind of nesting boxes of narrative that we have here. So,
well, that's assuming that he's not, we don't know how he would do that, but that's assuming that he's not just reporting verbatim what the monster said.
Right. Even if he is reporting verbatim what the monster said, like whatever report we have of the consciousness and thought and feeling of the creature, Frankenstein has that too, because he's reporting it, right? And so, I don't know, like his inability to have any kind of a layered or textured response to the creation just seemed irrational to me, inexplicable, right? And Shelley actually addresses that in her 1831 introduction, right? Because she says in the 1831 introduction, frightful must it be, for supremely frightful would be the effect of any human endeavor to mock the stupendous mechanism of the creator of the world. So she basically, in that introduction, put this religious reading of it where, you know, like kind of the most basic, one of the most basic interpretations of Frankenstein is, well, he's playing God. He's playing God in an act of scientific hubris, and that's awful, right? And I don't know that the 1818 text in a vacuum necessarily actually, that doesn't seem to me to really be the focus of it. But in 1831, Shelley added that layer of interpretation and kind of said he's repulsed by it because he realizes he's been taking on the role of the creator, and that's a horrible, blasphemous thing, and that's why you really couldn't have any other response other than his consistent loathing for his own creation. The reason I bring all that up, though, is I think that relationship, how you perceive that relationship between the creator and the created, and the legitimacy or illegitimacy of the loathing that the creator feels for the creature he's created, I think that really colors how you think about that Paradise Lost analogy, right? If your perception is that Frankenstein is in fact justified in his loathing because of that kind of religious frame, then that relates differently to the Paradise Lost comparison than, I mean, my own thought in reading it in a vacuum without knowing Shelley's introduction was, in some ways, like Frankenstein is the most monstrous person because he creates this living empathetic being, and then is unable to. He creates this living empathetic being and then is unable himself to have the level of empathy toward it that it actually feels, or that I'm using it, which is maybe cruel to the character, but for convenience's sake, right, Frankenstein creates this thing that has a much greater level of feeling and empathy than he is able to show toward it, right? And right. that is, that to, in my own reading of it, that felt like the most tragic thing was that lack of empathy.
Right,
but
right.
the filter that Shelley put on it in 1831 actually comes at it from a different perspective.
Oh, okay. Yeah, my initial reading is corresponds pretty much with yours, Hans, that the actual monster, regardless of the creature's actions, which are, you know, heinous enough, but also they come out of a history of, you know, deprivation and you know, people despising him, so you can kind of understand it. But it would seem to me that Frankenstein is, if there is a monster in the novel, it's actually Frankenstein himself, right? And you're saying that Shelley says that his repulsion with his creation is follows from like his recognition that he shouldn't have played God.
Well, I mean that's the reading of Shelley's introduction that was in one thing that we talked about last week was finding a secondary source.
Right.
And
yeah.
I had read Politics of Negation and Frankenstein and Ex Machina by Despina Kakudaki. Despina Kakudaki. And that was Despina's reading of that introduction. I did not come to that fresh and develop that reading.
Oh, all right. But, sure.
But the reading in that source, yeah, was that what Shelley did in the 1831 introduction was legitimize Frankenstein's repulsion toward the creation.
I mean, so this is interesting because my version didn't have that introduction, and it doesn't give any description of the creature until later, like where Frankenstein describes his face a little bit with these monstrous lips and huge white teeth, and you know he's really big and really strong. Does your version have that?
In my version, it's pretty clear that he's big and strong. Well, not that he's big and strong precisely, so much as just that he has a level of capability that is significantly beyond that of a human, right?
Right. Yeah,
his endurance, his strength. I don't remember any big lips or white teeth, though.
I think I remember that.
Okay. Yeah, that might be an introduction in the 1831 edition.
Right. Yeah, there were actual differences, not just in the introduction, but she changed textual bits in the novel itself.
Okay.
She emphasized Victor Frankenstein's lack of control over his own sort of like path, and made it, I think, like, I'm going off of real, I'm Googling it right now, so please take this with a grain of salt. It seems that she basically played up the fate that this sort of this antagonistic relationship between Frankenstein and his creation was fated, and changed things in the novel to play that up. People have pretty different feelings about. It's just, again, going off of Google, you know, whether that was to the novel's credit or not.
Interesting. I really want to know which version I read now.
It should be in the description. I have kind of an alternative reading of why, and this is kind of going back to Paradise Lost, like I actually felt like there was there was very little that felt connected in any way to sort of archetypal figures in this in a way that like made it feel religious or mythological in any way. It felt, and I guess it was the ambiguity that Hans was describing. That, and I really enjoyed that about the novel. And the source that I found, and I don't have the original source because it was written in 1979. I only have a reference to the original source. The original source being Peter Brooks's Godlike Science, Unhallowed Acts, Language, Nature, and Monstrosity and Frankenstein. And the source that I'm finding it in, I looked for a little bit for the, I have a source that I found that it may be the original source, but I don't know if it looks very, doesn't look quite right. But I found this in Mary Shelley's Sublime Bodies, Frankenstein, Matilda, and the Last Man by Steve Vine. And he has the first part of this essay is on Frankenstein, and the really interesting to me idea of this reading of Frankenstein that he's sort of building on for this piece that that Vine is writing is that Frankenstein's monster is that Frankenstein's monster, the creature, is a empathetic person who is outside of the symbolic like order. So the words that we would use to describe the monster fail to describe the monster, fail to connect that monster to a sense of being, to a sense of identity. And in that way, the monster is and this is what is most frightening about the monster. And this kind of resonated with my experience of the book. What is terrible about the monster is his physicality, is his body, which we never get, we get some pieces of, but it's very vague. Mm. His descriptions of the body are very vague. Mm. We hear that in pieces, Frankenstein assembled the creature to be beautiful. But then in animation, the monster is terrifying and horrible. And we get it not just from Frankenstein, but through Frankenstein's narration from others who see him. We also get it from Walton, the ship's captain. But never saw anything very clear. And it really resonated with me as kind of, actually a sort of a secular reading of the monster's awfulness being that there is no seat, there's no symbolic seat or schema in which the monster fits. And in this way, the monster is this sort of very unignorable, inescapable, reprehensible, gross body, this physical, mundane creature that nonetheless has the spark of intelligence and empathy, and in that way is horrifying, and is something that instinctively those of us who have a symbol, whose identities are connected in through language and through shared ideas of identity, back to sort of transcendental signifiers of personhood that we revile. And actually, you mentioned how it was sort of good chance that we followed up Milton's Paradise Lost with this novel. I actually felt like it was maybe more good, not good chance, or kismet, or what have you, but it's actually interesting to me that we're reading this novel and talking about it in light of the murder of, I'm sorry, what's his name? Floyd?
George Floyd?
George Floyd. Yeah, because there is this hatred, especially in the ambiguous version, what I take to be the more ambiguous version of the novel, this hatred of the monster feels, it just calls attention to itself as very odd. Like, it's just an instinctive hatred that doesn't seem possible just in sort of response to anything that is just purely like attributable to like features, and then nothing is sort of like really defined in any features that to really justify that horror. And I feel like, I don't know, there's something interesting in Frankenstein's lack of concern, or the opposite, his sense of mission to demolish this creature, to kill this creature, and his lack of a sense of value for the creature's personhood. And I really responded to that, I think, more so than any kind of like religious opposition.
Well, no, that's super interesting, because no, I absolutely agree. What I respond to is like this weird inability of Frankenstein to recognize the personhood of his creation. And it's interesting, because in the outside text I read, John B. Lamb's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and Milton's Monstrous Myth, which is a kind of a, I don't know if we need all that alliteration, but whatever. he writes, Frankenstein should be read as an attack upon the monologic and monolithic voice of Paradise Lost. So according to Lamb, he thinks that the book is actually, it's a response to Milton, but like a critique, like a criticism of Milton, maybe suggesting that just as Frankenstein couldn't recognize his creature's personhood, maybe you know, the god of Paradise Lost also has that shortcoming.
One thing that I thought was interesting, and I don't know how much this illuminates everything that we've been talking about, but the one distinction between the 1818 and 1831 text, the 1818 text started with an epigraph from Paradise Lost. Did I request thee, Maker, from my clay to mold me man? Did I solicit thee from darkness to promote me? And Shelley removed that from the 1831 text.
Hmm.
And that epigraph, I think, very, very much backs up that reading that you were talking about just now, Patrick, right?
Yeah.
I think that epigraph very much enforces that reading of a parallel between God's inability to recognize the empathy and sophistication of Satan and Frankenstein's inability to recognize the empathy of the monster.
And I do recall my version had that epigraph, so I must have listened to the 1818 version.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting that Shelley took that out, because it seems like she almost for whatever reason became a little bit frightened of that reading.
Right, yeah, maybe. Like, she's backtracking from criticisms of God the Creator, and maybe is worried about her eternal soul or something.
or her social position, or who knows.
Well, yeah. You know, yeah, her social position.
Which, I mean, like, what you guys blame, I agree. Victor Frankenstein is especially at the end, it felt like it had to be intended, or at least at this point, it doesn't matter if it was or wasn't, but like, when Victor Frankenstein is on his deathbed and he's saying, like, I looking back, I don't know how I could have behaved any differently, you know, like,
right, yeah,
you know, I you know, and it's like, fuck you, man.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
you,
absolutely.
Hey, you are a piece of shit. And
you guys keep talking, but my daughter needs something. Just a second.
Okay. Yeah. Aw.
I wonder.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, no. Did you have more to say about your thing? Because I was going to transition to a different question. So.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, he, as the sort of like the protagonist of the novel, he's so, I don't remember enough about romantic literature and whether or not, like, you know, obviously at the end he's striking on it out on his own across the ice, you know, and he's doing a lot of physically heroic things, but he's, whoa, oh my, but he's such a whiny little bitch, like, throughout. Through the whole novel, like, just basically, like, everything is happening to him. And I couldn't remember if there was something, if there was some sort of place in romantic literature for this sort of, like, vacillating, weak, like, I became just sort of, like, I entered a fugue state for several months. And, like, years go by, and he's just such a bitch, like, he just is. Everything is happening, and I don't know, like, this is kind of a question about context. Are we supposed to be confused about, like, whether or not he is someone who are we supposed to empathize with him beyond his, you know, like, well, the terrible things that do happen to him, and he deserves some consideration for that, but he's just so awful.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're bringing up the context of romanticism, Chris. I mean, it's been a while since I studied much romantic literature, but my understanding of, my recollection of romanticism is that one of the things that is usually considered to be within the sphere of the romantic is inexplicable passion, right? Or intuition,
yeah,
acting
so.
Through inexplicable passion. And it is, I mean, when Frankenstein creates the creature, it's interesting that there's not really a whole lot of time spent on his feeling or his state of mind or his goals while he's doing that, right? Like, that segment passes very quickly relative to a lot of the rest of the novel. But the, I mean, that is kind of presented as this illogical, unexamined drive, that it's almost sexual in the sense that it has the same kind of arc of a poorly considered sexual encounter, right? Where you desperately want to do something and you don't totally question why. And then as soon as you're done, this kind of fog of, oh my God, I'm an idiot, just kind of clears from your eyes, right?
You look across and you see the monster.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like that, where he has this deep, he's driven for maybe a couple years on this deeply irrational project that he doesn't understand. And the instant it's done, there's just this immediate, immense regret. And that in some ways seems romantic to me. And also his the kind of the loathing that he feels, right, is an inexplicable passion. In its way, I suppose you could read those as romantic, although I don't think that they are, if anything, they might be a critique of those ideas in romanticism, you know, a critique of the glorification of irrational passion.
Yeah.
You were going to say something though, Hans.
Well, and maybe, I don't know if this will go anywhere, because I, if you put me on the spot, I don't know if I could form a thought around this, but we've talked a lot about connections between this and some other things that we've read and external events. How does this speak to Myra Breckinridge, if at all? Because Myra Breckinridge is, I mean, the Myra Breckinridge is self-created in some sense, right? The Myra Breckinridge, Myron creates Myra. even in a physical sense, by like going through a series of surgeries to physically become Myra. Is there some conceptual overlap there that's illuminating? Maybe not.
Maybe in that the monster seems to be in at least some ways superior.
Oh, there you go.
And yeah, and that there are clear, I think pretty overt questions about, you know, like man's role in a world populated by monsters like Frankenstein's monster. If Frankenstein followed through on the creation of the monstress, and the world were populated by an oppositional force of these people who are far more capable physically, who can get by on eating food that we cannot, who basically just have like whatever they, you know, Frankenstein's monster is untouchable in this novel. Like there's nothing that can be done about them. And maybe that's it. Maybe it's one or the other. You know, this is like that sort of like tipping point watershed moment that we talk about now with like AI. You know, we write stories and create movies about that first AI that is just going to be like an unstoppable force that will either obey us, love us too much to kill us, or just completely replace us,
or advance to some kind of higher plane where we're irrelevant.
Yeah,
that's a really interesting parallel, actually, between
except that the creature, none of those seem open to the creature.
Well, I think I'm just, when I say it's an interesting parallel, I don't mean between those outcomes so much as it's an interesting parallel around the fear, right? The way that fear functions in, the point, I guess, is that part of the fear that Frankenstein is experiencing here, which is so inexplicable, part of that fear and revulsion may actually be rooted in an awareness of the power of the thing that he has created, right? And that, in some ways, actually seems more sympathetic and explicable than fear rooted in, well, it looks ugly, right?
Yeah.
If part of the fear is allowing this creature to perpetuate will ultimately threaten the well-being of humanity, that's
actually a consequentialist line of reasoning that he engages in. Frankenstein.
It is, yeah. And it's not emphasized as much as some of the other feelings that he has, but it seems to me like the most sympathetic reading of his motivation. And part of the reason that does resonate as sympathetic is because that's a type of fear that continues to be reflected in all kinds of both narrative fiction and also real kind of scientific, popular scientific discourse today, right? I mean, it's a fear that I've expressed. I'm personally scared shitless of artificial intelligence.
Are you?
Well,
not to go down that road, but
let's go down that road.
We
because,
should
like,
go down
oh, sorry.
That road. Why are you scared of AI?
Because before I say anything, I should say that I don't actually have the knowledge or expertise to have an informed opinion, and you know, I recognize that this is not someone who was an actual AI researcher might have very different ideas. And
you wrote a book about AI.
I did, yeah.
And you,
well,
I would assume you researched it for that, right?
Yeah, Hans, I'd hate to believe that you wrote a book about it and you can't talk about it.
I wrote that book in such a hurry. I mean, that was a book that if I had written that book with the level of expertise and preparation that like the ambition required, it would have taken about 10 years, but I didn't want to budget more than 6 months, so
anyway,
well, having fucked that up, I'm now going to continue to express ignorant opinions on the same topic. But.
Well, I'm interested.
Let me give. Oh, can I put in real
ahead.
Quick? Sorry.
No big deal.
It's because like it occurs to me, there's a couple of points in this where like Frankenstein warns Walton that the monster is very eloquent, but don't let them fool you. And he remonstrates himself for being carried away by the monster's words, which isn't really actually something that's super shown, I think. Like, it's one of those things where you wonder about, like, Victor Frankenstein's telling of the story. Like, he doesn't really give a lot of room for himself to be swayed by the monster. Like, he's only swayed for brief periods of time, but then he seems to convey that the monster's eloquence actually is very convincing. And I guess he did spend a year, I think it's a year, right, trying to create the monstrous. But so there's a lot there that kind of feels like glossed over, and maybe that's telling, because I'm actually thinking, Hans, you saw Ex Machina, have you seen that? Yeah. And have you seen that, Patrick?
Yeah, I saw it.
Yeah, I think it's a masterpiece. It's really good. But what occurs to me, kind of going back to the,
I don't know about that, but whatever.
Yeah, well, okay. But going back to the critical reading that I, the reading that I found, the monster is monstrous because he's a body with a lack of symbols. And it strikes me that one of the horrifying thing in Ex Machina, without giving too much away in the end, is the mistake is reading the mistake that Domhnall Gleeson's character makes is reading the symbols that signify the identity of this AI and actually being convinced of them and so convinced of the AI's selfhood and identity as something that he can relate to. And I wonder, I don't know if there's something, there's connective tissue here, but it seems like the monster in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, for whatever reason, is just not maybe monstrousness a feature, or maybe it's just like a different character of like the society and the culture at the time. But Mary Shelley seems to believe that we would not be so confused, that her characters would not be so confused. They would look at this abomination and they would know it as an abomination.
Right.
They just know it. And
I mean, it does seem to be related to its features, even though we don't get a really specific description of them.
Yeah.
Like why else would characters immediately react with revulsion unless, you know, the monster is hideous.
Why else would someone literally go through a fugue state for several months? I don't know. Like, these are like very emotional people.
Well, that's true.
There's something like they're more attuned with something that is non-corporeal. I don't know what it is.
Fair enough.
They're very romantic, but I don't. It just strikes me as very interesting suddenly that like Hans, could you characterize like your revulsion is not a word you've used, but like your fear of AI as something that.
Well, like, I mean, my concern about AI is that, and this isn't original, right? This is pretty much just coming from a book I read by Nick Bostrom. So, you know, I'm basically just taking the thing that Nick Bostrom told me to be afraid of, but, my concern is about creating something that is more powerful than we are without maybe fully understanding what its motivations or goals will be. Like, as soon as you create something that is more intelligent and powerful than you are, you've created something that is, you've created something that you cannot understand. And if you cannot understand it, then you cannot predict, control, judge. You don't have any sense of what it's going to do or why. And that just seems like a very dangerous thing to unleash. And I know that there's more to it than that, but that's the core of the fear.
What is
inexplicability, which is actually, I don't think really applies necessarily to Frankenstein's creation, because ultimately Frankenstein's creation is deeply explicable, right?
Right.
The whole
yeah.
point of it is that it has a deeply, deeply human set of feelings and motivations.
Right, right.
That, so it says, is there a reading of the novel where Frankenstein's warning about the monster's eloquence is hinting at something more, or is that just like, me?
Like a reading of the novel where the creature actually does want a female creature so that it can make a bunch of super powerful children and wipe out the human race?
Not necessarily. I just was thinking,
this conversation
I'm kind of going
is
off of,
going in places I did not suspect, but that's a problem.
Well, I'm just thinking about Ex Machina, because like the whole the fact that the female AI, or the AI is placed in a female looking human body, has nothing to do with the AI's
Suppose in some ways they're inverse, right? Like in Ex Machina, the AI is placed in a female looking human body, and its female appearance allows people to overlook its complete inexplicability. In Frankenstein, the creation is placed in an inhuman-looking body, which allows people to overlook its completely conventional feelings and emotions. They're opposites in that regard.
Right, right, right. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, I think you're right. I was going for something that doesn't quite fit.
Well, I mean, there certainly seem to be parallels between the two movies. Like, just as there are parallels between Paradise Lost and this, you know, there's like inversions, you know, according to the article I read, the book is specifically trying to, you know, revise Milton, you know, or critique him or whatever. So there's certainly different comparisons of any kind to be made.
Yeah.
Patrick, can I ask you a question? Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Hans, you were going to say something? Sorry.
Well, I just, and maybe this is a wrapping up point, so maybe I'm timing it wrong, but what I came away with more than anything was that what I find most admirable and most interesting about the novel is its inexplicability, right? There's so much that is not described, revealed. The reasoning behind most of what Frankenstein does is obscured. In a lot of ways, it's very minimal and very skeletal, and most of what occurs in it is a series of irrational passions, right? And I think that's part of what's made it enduring is, at least the 1818 text is this little enigma. It's this horrifying little bundle of uncertainties and questions. And almost immediately people began building layers of interpretation and, you know, creating images to fill in the uncertainties. But if you take the original version of it just on its own, it's most intriguing as kind of this collection of unknowns. But sorry, what were you going to say, Chris?
I was going to ask a joke question, so.
Oh.
Well, before you do
the
that,
foundations for it are ruined.
Well, I wanted to kind of play off what Hans was saying about its ambiguity, and you know I agree it's ambiguous in all those ways. The most interesting form of ambiguity I found to be was its moral ambiguity. You know, even if we read the novel as a critique of Milton, there's still the question of, you know, maybe Frankenstein does act monstrously, but there's still this kind of moral ambiguity in what the creation does. You know, we understand why he's murdering all of these people in an effort to get revenge, and yet his empathy remains. Like, think about how I found that extremely interesting, how we're still able to empathize with this character who's really done some pretty awful things, you know, murdering innocent people left and right, just as a method of getting back at somebody who wronged him. And there's the earlier we mentioned, you know, Frankenstein's consequentialist reasoning, like, maybe I need to get rid of this creature so that it doesn't come to replace humanity, which I think is probably a slippery slope argument. There's also the question of more Kantian moral reasoning at hand, because so definitely the monster, I don't want to say the monster, I don't like that, the creation treats all of these people in Frankenstein's lives as means rather than ends, right? You know, they're all means to get at Frankenstein, and so that moral ambiguity where clearly the monster is acting immorally, and yet we still seem to care a lot about him, is super interesting to me.
Yeah, where do you think that comes from, the fact that we continue to care about him like we do? Is it just because of sympathy for the ways in which he is persecuted or loathed irrationally?
Right.
Is it easier to feel sympathy because his persecution is irrational? It's interesting that his, like, the framing of his experience creates this effect where on an emotional gut level, it's easier to understand strangling a 6-year-old boy than being grossed out by a hideous monster.
Right.
I'm to some extent exaggerating that for rhetorical effect, but, you know, that's a perspective on the emotional relationship that most readers are going to end up having to the book. Which is really quite a trick when you think about it.
It is. Like, I really loved this novel, and, you know, when Chris, you said, oh, it's great, I was like, oh, okay, cool. And I really think it's great. You know, I was pretty much thinking it was awesome from the first word to the last. It was super good.
I agree.
It's awesome. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
Maybe we forgive Frankenstein's creation because their creation, like, they can never be fully responsible for their actions. In some fundamental way, there is always something that connects causally back to Victor Frankenstein.
Right. So we're wondering whether, you know, determinism has some kind of effect on moral responsibility, which it, you know, undoubtedly
does.
There's probably
there's one, I don't know if you caught it, the Frankenstein's creation refers to himself as an abortion.
Yeah.
At the end, which really sticks out.
It does. It really does.
It's a powerful, it's like the one time that a PG-13 movie is allowed to use the word fuck.
Right.
And so they have to pick that moment really well. And it was just like, you know, obviously I feel like I haven't done the research, but I feel like that's probably a pretty heavy word,
you know,
to use really almost any time but especially I'd think in the 1800s.
I wonder what the resonance of that word would have been in the 1800s, right?
Yeah.
If people applied that term, I mean, my understanding is that at one point, abortion meant stopping of anything in progress.
Abort.
And then at some point, abort the mission, you know, and then because of the cultural significance of the particular matter of stopping a pregnancy, it's come to have kind of a resonance with us that I don't know how people would have responded to that word at that time, right?
But I really wonder what he means specifically, like when he calls himself an abortion, what was aborted? Like, what is it, that final step where Frankenstein needed to take responsibility as a creator and love his creation? Is that what was aborted?
I really, you're totally right, Hans and Patrick. Like, I never didn't think about how the word might not have even referred to an aborted pregnancy.
Right.
At the time, if not, it's really happened to, the word has happened. The word's meaning has happened to evolve in such a way to make that line really powerful.
Yeah.
But if it did refer to an aborted pregnancy, I don't have it pulled up in front of me, but basically, like, the line is in the context of not being rejected by all of humanity,
right?
And in that way, I think the connection is to, you know, to an aborted fetus who is not even wanted by its mother,
right?
You know, so I guess like that's how I read it. But
even if that's not in line with how the word would have been used back then, it's still a great, like you said, you know, the word has evolved in such a way that it's still super powerful.
And could you hold an aborted person responsible for anything?
Probably not.
They exist outside. We've rejected them in like humanity and all of, like, you know, and murder is sort of the other form of this, I guess, but I don't know. There's something I think that absolves the creation of guilt, that they can do anything and we would not blame them.
Mm-hmm. Super, super neat. Super good book. So what do you say? It looks like I'm third in line. So I guess it's Chris's pick next time.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh shoot.
Oh Jesus, yeah, Chris. You always freaking do this, man.
No. You say that, but it's not true. You're full of crap.
You did it last time. You're like, Daryl, what should we read?
Well, all right. Let me take a look. I'll
You take your time.
What have I wanted to read? I'll take my time.
Yeah. You just message us and let us know.
I will.
In the meantime, I will continue re-listening to The Road to Wigan Pier. But I did want to say, dudes, in that extra week we had, I decided to listen to another John Fowles book, The Collector. Did you guys like the French Lieutenant's Woman? You guys liked it, right?
I adored the French Lieutenant's Woman.
Yeah, I thought it was great, too.
I'm very, very fond of it.
Yeah. It was super good. And The Collector was also super good. That was his first one. So I don't know if you guys have read it, but I'm just saying The Collector was super good. And you know, if you like The French Lieutenant's Woman, maybe you want to read more of Fowles. Anyway.
I am very likely to do that, yeah.
Cool. All right, gents. Awesome, as usual. It's great talking to you guys. We look forward to what you're going to pick, Chris. And
I do, too.
Yeah. Everyone, stay safe out in a world where the police will pepper spray you for protesting a murder. So peace out, everyone. Have a good one.
All right.
See you guys later.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
See you guys.